Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Gary Greenberg spoke to us earlier this year about his book, Manufacturing Depression, about what he sees as the overprescription of antidepressants, he sparked a lively discussion. 68 listeners commented on our show page, and that's a strong response. He says many people ask after reading his book, who's he trying to piss off? Now he's sure to rile up even more readers with an article he's written about positive psychology, a school that argues the goal of psychotherapy should simply be to maintain psychological well-being. The War on Unhappiness is in the September issue of Harper's Magazine. I'm very pleased that it brings Gary Greenberg back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, it's good to be back.
When was positive psychology created?
So in the 1990s is when Martin Seligman got interested in trying to create a psychology of happiness and techniques to get there.
But this sounds like the sort of thing that we've been hearing about ever since the 60s, all the new schools that came out of the Esalen Institute. How is this any different?
Well, in some ways, it's the same in that those schools focused on what we might call hedonism or hedonic virtues.
Well, they said that they were following Aldous Huxley's call for finding out how to extend the human potential.
The problem with that is that if you pursue simply unfettered human potential, then you can go to excess. And I think that in some people's view anyway, that's exactly what happened in the late 60s through the middle 70s. I think what Seligman has tried to do is to say that happiness consists of more than subjective well-being. It also involves meaning and positive relationships and a certain kind of engagement with the world. It's actually a return to the classical virtues.
Well, people have always, I think, went into therapy saying, you know, I just want to be happy.
That's right. And I think, at that level, sort of at our everyday understanding of the word, you can't argue with that as a goal. I mean, sure, we all in some way want to be happy.
Well, how is it regarded in the psychological community?
I'm sorry, positive psychology?
Yeah. Happiness, I'm sure, is regarded as a positive.
Yes. Although some people like me would argue with that. I believe that it has quite a bit of traction, not necessarily the particular school that Martin Seligman has founded, but the general idea that the therapist's job is to help the patient achieve a kind of state of happiness has become very, very common in my profession.
Well, how does it deviate from all of the mainstream therapy schools?
Well, I don't know. I think it might be the mainstream therapy school now, but what it really deviates from is the historical underpinnings of therapy, which, of course, would be Freud and psychoanalysis. Freud wasn't all that interested in happiness. He thought that the best a person could hope for was to move from neurotic misery to common unhappiness. Freud thought that life was inherently tragic and difficult and uncomfortable, and that a certain kind of stoicism is what he was after.
Well, is that any better? I'm not sure that that's the way I want to see. That sounds kind of bleak. I'm not sure that's the way I would like to get healthier to become.
Yeah, and I don't know how to account for the differences among people about this. I'm much more attracted to that view, that more, I suppose, dour view of our prospects and of what life is for. But I don't know in the end that we can figure that out. You'd have to be able to stand outside of the universe to decide if this is which of these perspectives is better.
Well, I remember way back in the 60s, and maybe it goes back even earlier, people who argued against therapy because they said that it would mean the death of art, that if people were no longer neurotic, they wouldn't have all of the impulses to create art. And of course, that didn't happen.
And the same charge has been leveled against psychoactive drugs like Prozac, that if you take away people's conflicts, there won't be any kind of creative production.
And Graham Greene was so overwhelmed by depression that until he took drugs, he really couldn't write.
Exactly. People's suffering can disable them. So there may be an optimal level of suffering, that we don't want to have too much of it, but it may be okay to say that we don't want to have too little of it either.
So a little bit of it actually is, this is like eating dirt or something. It actually immunizes us against other things.
That's an interesting way to think of it. I haven't been eating dirt recently, so I can't.
Well, you know what I mean. They say that if we use all these bacterial soaps and everything, we're actually causing ourselves harm.
Yeah, there is something to be said for exposing ourselves to a certain amount of pain and suffering.
So how does positive psychology work? Does it follow the usual trappings of from the Freudian lineage, the couch or
the
face-to-face talking career, hypnosis, all those other things?
I think it finds its way into different schools of therapy in different fashion. I think the most lively connection is between the kind of research that Seligman is doing and cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a therapy that is designed to help people be functional. It sets its goals on having people be able to live a life where they're untroubled. And I think that the research that Seligman is doing is in the direction of finding the techniques that will achieve that.
Well, and Freud said that all of our problems resided in things that happened when we were very young, maybe even prenatal things. And then we had to figure out what they were and understand them, and then we would be able to live with them. But then later therapies became much more of the moment, existential therapy, Gestalt therapy. Where does this fit in?
I think this is a much more present-oriented. In fact, what Seligman says is that it's a future-oriented therapy. That the idea
might as well be Scientology, then.
Well, I suppose you'd have to take that up with him. I'm sure there are some differences.
But what do you mean by future? I interrupted you.
That's too bad. I thought I was going to get off the hook on that. I think what he means by that is that you think about how you want human beings to be, and then you create the psychological conditions under which it's most likely that that will happen.
Well, he says that unhappiness is learned. How would he define unhappiness? Is it synonymous with depression or just a sense of malaise?
Well, what Seligman is really talking about us having learned is helplessness, not necessarily unhappiness. But I think that the overall approach that he takes is that it's the way we think about our lives that causes us to be unhappy.
My guest is Gary Greenberg, has written an article called The War on Unhappiness that is in the September issue of Harper's Magazine. Is this all that similar to The Secret of a few years ago? Are people unhappy because they're putting unhappy vibes out into the world?
Well, you know, I don't know how actually to compare these except to say one thing. They have in common the idea that if you just change the way that you approach your life, then everything will fall into your lap.
Well, this is nothing new, is it? Years ago, there were books like I'm OK, You're OK that
became bestsellers. Oh, it's older than that.
Est was very popular for a while.
It's much older than that. This is coming back to Dale Carnegie and Norman Vincent Peale.
The Power of Positive Thinking.
The Power of Positive Thinking and Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's a peculiar strain of American optimism, which says that if you adopt the right mental techniques, then your life will improve in a way that will make things better.
So this is something that's only caught on in the United States?
I don't know that it only caught on here. I mean, it's not an accident that it is here. America is the country that's dedicated to the pursuit of happiness. That's not a coincidence. And I think we do tend to value optimism and devalue pessimism in this country more than many other countries do.
Well, did you happen to see the Forbes list of the world's happiest countries that they published earlier this year? Scandinavia sweeps the list with Denmark, Finland, Norway, Netherlands, and Sweden at the top. Israel beats the United States. In fact, the United States is in 14th place, right below Panama.
Yes, I did see that.
So maybe we do have a problem.
Well, I think that, you know, when you ask people about happiness, and this is one of the problems with positive psychology, you have to start with a definition of what happiness is. Now, I'm going to guess that whatever questions they asked in this Gallup poll somehow skewed the results toward countries with strong social safety nets, because that's one of the things that Scandinavian countries have in common and that the United States notably doesn't have. And I think what you're seeing there is that prosperity alone, or at least per capita income alone, isn't sufficient to bring about the state that the people themselves would call happy.
You admit in the article that one of the problems is that traditional therapies have a mediocre success rate. And I remember my parents had friends who were in psychoanalysis for 30 or 40 years, and we would wonder whether they were getting any better or whether they were just simply paying a doctor to hear their kvetching.
Well, I don't know that – I didn't mean to admit that psychotherapy has a mediocre success rate.
You used the word.
Well, I think I was quoting somebody. But what I would say is that therapy works in about 70% of the cases. If you got a 70 on your report card, that would be a C, and a C is considered to be mediocre. However, I think that the fact that 7 out of 10 people can go and talk to somebody and share that intimacy with them and come out of it on the other side – feeling better in some way that's important to them, I think that's actually really quite good. I think it's maybe a minor miracle.
But you also point out that it doesn't really matter which school your therapist is in. You can go to Gestalt therapist, existential therapist, cognitive behavioral therapist, et cetera, and the outcomes are all pretty much the same.
That's right. That's called the dodo bird effect because the first person who discovered it remembered that the dodo bird in Alice in Wonderland to judge a contest said, well, everybody's won and all must have prizes. In fact, that also isn't – I think that's a remarkable finding, and I think it makes sense. The therapy works by the placebo effect. And the placebo effect is what happens when two people enter into a caring relationship with the intention of one of them being healed. And again, the fact that that works so often is just a testimony to how powerful it is.
So if you desire to improve and you talk about your problems, you're eventually going to understand what's messing you up and you'll improve.
If you're talking to the right...
You couldn't do this with a friend?
Maybe. But it seems that if you make the right connection with a therapist, you're going to do better than you would if you did it with a friend. But there's no question therapy is a substitute for intimacy that otherwise is very hard to come by in this society.
And for years, therapists said, this is really an art.
Yeah. And
this is not science.
I think they were right. I think therapy's been misplaced in the category, in the medical category, and that's been primarily for economic reasons. There's been no real other justification for it to be considered a medical practice other than that the doctors took it over in the early 20th century and we can make better money this way.
Well, but there are various forms of psychology. Some of it has to be medical. If someone's schizophrenic, some people might say the talking cure works, but it usually doesn't work. That's where you have to try other approaches.
And someday somebody may find where that line is between the kinds of mental suffering that are best treated within the medical industry and those that are best treated outside of it. What I'm saying isn't that none of it should be inside. I'm saying that all of it is inside now and probably shouldn't be.
Neuroses is not a medical condition.
I believe that's true.
And isn't most psychotherapy really dealing with neuroses?
Well, for the walking...
A kind of middle-class problem?
For the walking wounded like you and me, I think that's right.
My guest is Gary Greenberg, who's written an article called The War on Unhappiness. It's in the September issue of Harper's Magazine, the magazine that's on the newsstands right now. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Gary Greenberg, who is a therapist and also a very stylish writer, I should point out. His book, Manufacturing Depression, brought him here earlier this year, and now an article called The War on Unhappiness, which is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. You mentioned that all therapies are part of medicine. That's partly because of the way we pay doctors, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not an accident. It was in 1926, the doctors in America staged a rearguard move and captured psychoanalysis, wrested it away from Freud, who did not want it to be a medical profession, and against his wishes claimed that psychoanalysis would only be practiced by physicians. And that's what started it. That's when therapy got into bed with medicine. And one of the offspring of that has been that we collect third-party payments.
But insurance companies also want to see results, and that's been a problem with mainstream therapies, hasn't it?
Well, for the first...
It's hard to quantify.
For the first 50 years, it wasn't a problem at all. Everybody was happy with the arrangement. And then starting in the 1970s, the insurance companies, for lots of different reasons, started to ask for some accountability. And that was very difficult to achieve because the question becomes, well, how do you measure? Some very smart psychologists, Martin Seligman being among them, began to figure out ways to quantify therapy. And of course, this changed the definition of what therapy was, what it was for, what it was supposed to accomplish, and who it would treat.
So how does positive psychology quantify therapy?
Oh, well,
you see real results?
Well, there's two different issues here. One of them is how positive psychology does it, and that's very clear. There's a website called AuthenticHappiness.org that anybody can go to, and there are exercises that you can do and tests that you can take. And using that very large database, Seligman has managed to correlate certain techniques, certain things people can do about their thinking with measures of depression and other indicators of happiness. Another thing that's going on that's independent of what Seligman is doing and more about what cognitive therapy is doing is engaging in a kind of reification of therapy, turning it into its little constituent parts and measuring on a moment-to-moment basis how a therapist is doing with a given patient.
Now, I jokingly mentioned Scientology earlier, but to some degree, isn't that what they're claiming they can do? They hook you up to an e-meter and you talk about the things that make you emotional. And once you have, you stop registering high voltage, you're cleared and you can move on past those problems.
And this is going to look a whole lot less ridiculous 25 years from now when it's not cognitive psychology, but rather imaging-based psychology. You know, people in MRIs and their brains telling us that they've gotten better. And the insurance companies, aside from the cost of the MRI or whatever, they're going to love that.
Well, you mentioned that there is a movement within the School of Psychiatry to hold therapists accountable. Accountable for what? I mean, other than... abusing
their position, making their patients better.
Well, how can you do that?
How can you do what? Make them better?
Well, one person might actually have a serious be a lot better than he was when he entered in therapy, but not see any improvement. Another person might be totally delusional and think that he's cured.
That's right, and so this is really the biggest problem. The people who are testing this stuff are the ones who get to decide what they're going to test for. And maybe regardless of exactly how a patient feels, if they respond to the tests in a certain way, then they are de facto better.
A listener, J.K. from the Bronx, asks on our comments page, is Dr. Greenberg saying that the years of training therapists have is not essential to the success of therapy? I find this somewhat disheartening as a fifth-year doctoral candidate in child psychology.
Well, I think the training is very important, particularly the part of it that has to do with both being in therapy yourself and also working under close supervision. I mean, therapy is a skill or a set of skills as well as an art. And there are certain things that one has to do in order to – certain experiences one has to have and certain courage that one has to develop in order to be with people who are troubled.
Perhaps J.K. misunderstood what you were saying. You're not saying that you want to get rid of psychotherapy.
No. What I'm saying is that there are certain approaches to it that constitute a complete turnaround from what we've become accustomed to. And actually, again, harken back to this time that Freud objected to the doctors taking over psychoanalysis. He said medical education is the worst possible education for being a therapist because it would cause people to look, it would cause the doctors to look for individual diseases that could be cured and attempt to cure them rather than to consider, first of all, the whole human being, and secondly, the fact that the human condition may well be incurable.
You suggest using a consumer-driven outcome management. What is that?
I didn't suggest that. I reported that somebody else suggested it. Yeah. That's an attempt on the part of certain psychologists to render a system of accountability. It turns therapists into bureaucrats and clients into consumers.
Can we back up? I want to go back to positive psychology per se. How does a patient in positive psychology unlearn his acquired unhappiness?
Well, I think that the basic idea is that you change your patterns of thinking. And one of the ways that you do that is you, for instance, develop the habit of thinking about what's positive in your life. It's very simple. One of the most interesting...
The power of positive thinking.
It is like that. But it's more focused than that. I mean, this isn't something that I endorse, but I think that some of the things they do are very interesting. For instance, Seligman has his people engage in what's called a... I can't remember the name right now, but he has them a gratitude visit. He has them write a 300-word essay about something that somebody did for them that they appreciated, but that they never expressed appreciation for. And then he has them go to that person, knock on their door, and read the testimonial to them. And not only does this create a very moving moment, but in Seligman's research anyway, it shows that people are less depressed over the next couple of months after they do that.
Now, what about people who always express their gratitude?
Well, ideally, this is...
They don't have to go into this therapy.
Ideally, this is how we would be.
Buddhists believe in the characteristic of emptiness. There is no good or bad, only the thoughts we project on our world. Is that what's going on in positive psychology?
I think that requires an enormous leap across cultural paradigms. I think that the language sounds right, but I actually don't think that what the Buddhists are talking about with respect to right thinking and what the positive psychologists are talking about has very much I don't think they're the same thing.
Although Esalen very much was concerned with merging Eastern and Western thinking.
Yes, and to some extent they did that, but it wasn't terribly systematic. And Esalen, again, and what goes on in cognitive therapy, there's quite a bit of divergence there.
The writing that's been done on happiness lately tends to point out that money has a negligible effect on the quality of life, and yet we don't live that way. Do you have any thoughts about why we chase those carrots?
Well, so what happens is that after a while, as income continues to increase, satisfaction or life satisfaction or happiness levels off, and that's the research that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so, why does that happen? Well, it happens probably because after a while, the things that money can buy you things that make you happy, but after a while, the amount of happiness that you can get by buying things diminishes. So there's clearly a point of diminishing returns.
Seligman recently has said that positive psychology is really not about happiness, but about well-being. Is he adjusting to the criticism?
I think that's part of what's going on. I think it's also because he has a very ambitious agenda. Seligman would like to see his program adopted. It's being adopted by the United States Army to create what he calls resilience in soldiers so that they might be inoculated against post-traumatic stress disorder.
My guest is Gary Greenberg, whose article, The War on Unhappiness, is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk about the government and positive psychology, not just the military, but also the CIA.
I don't know that the CIA is involved in this particular project. Seligman was tangentially involved with the CIA, and his writing on what he called learned helplessness was used. His concepts of learned helplessness were clearly used in the enhanced interrogation or torture program carried out by our interrogators.
But he didn't endorse that.
After the fact, he said that he didn't endorse it.
So... You think he may have been consulted?
He was consulted. Oh. It's just not clear that he knew what he was being consulted for.
So let's talk about the Army and positive psychology. When did the Army call on Seligman?
Well, according to him, I believe it was toward the end of 2008.
And so fairly late in this whole thing.
Yes, and with the question of, well, what are we going to do about all these returning soldiers? This is Seligman's account. I haven't verified this.
Is this because there are growing concerns about PTSD?
Yeah, of course. And as Seligman put it, the Army, the current people who run the Army, George Casey in particular, he mentioned, doesn't want his legacy to be a lot of traumatized soldiers. And asked Seligman, what should we do about this? Asked him, I suppose, as a leading psychologist, and Seligman's response was to say, well, rather we should continue to treat them, but the more important thing is to engage in prevention. And while I think it's clear that the easiest way to prevent PTSD in soldiers is not to send them to war in the first place. Seligman's view was we can essentially inoculate them by making it more likely that when they're exposed to trauma, they won't be traumatized by it.
And how would we do that? Put them all through some form of therapy?
Yeah, well, put them all through this this program that Seligman has developed that involves exercises like the one I mentioned before, which sort of inculcates habits of positive thinking.
Has psychological conditioning ever been tested on troops or applied to civilians before?
Probably, but not on this scale. I mean, we're talking this program is being implemented with more than a million soldiers as we speak.
His goal is to create a psychologically fit army.
I believe that the goal that Seligman has and the goal that the Army has is to create an army who aren't terribly bothered by the horror of war, which, frankly, I find a little bit disturbing.
What about, the Department of Defense seems to like his ideas. What about the NIH?
Well, in Seligman's view, what's really going on is that his brand of psychology is not about pathology anymore. It's not about what's wrong with us. It's about what's right with us. And he finds that it's really interesting that the Department of Defense is interested in this much more than the National Institutes of Health are. The NIH, he says, are much more interested in pathology, and the DOD is interested in making us happy.
A listener, Julian from New Jersey, asks, how does life coaching fit into this point of view? It's become quite popular, and people are replacing therapists with coaches.
Yeah, in large numbers. So how does it fit in? Well, clearly, life coaching is one of the domains of positive psychology. It's based on the idea that given the right attitude and the right techniques, you can achieve your goals, and the life coach works with you to identify them and achieve them.
Now, you're a therapist. Mm-hmm. Do you see absolutely no value in this for your practice?
I don't see no value in it. I think the techniques that I think that the things that Seligman's trying to get at with these techniques, many of them are important. People do need to be able to see their lives in some kind of perspective. And when people are unduly pessimistic, they need to be reminded, to put it simply, to count their blessings. There's a lot of therapy that is can turn into a lot of whining.
Well, you speak of your work as a battle of doubt and certainty. Is that what regular psychotherapy is?
I think that Freud's idea originally, and the one idea of Freud that's worth preserving, there are many that are worth throwing away, but one that's really worth preserving is his idea that certainty is something we shouldn't adopt too early in the game, that piety and earnestness are really problematic because they get us to discard other possibilities way too easily. So to me, what's important in therapy is to keep the conversation open and not come to some kind of conclusion about what life is for or about how it should feel or about how to get to where we want to go or about whether or not where we want to go is a good place.
Do you see these new therapies as having a negative effect, or are they just a waste of people's money in your mind?
I think that the question about these new therapies is more of a political one than a psychological one. I mean, I think that the really interesting question here is what happens if you, as Seligman would like to, transform an entire society into one who sees its job as to just forge ahead with as much optimism as possible. Alexis de Tocqueville said something really interesting when he came into this country and visited in 1840. He said that the country that the people that ask nothing of their government except to ensure their well-being are the people that await the hand that binds them. It's possible to get too interested in our own psychological well-being and forget about the things that cause us pain, like the political problems that we face.
Well, that was Tocqueville, but yes. You also quote Sigmund Freud when he came to the United States the first time, accompanied by Carl Jung. He said to Jung, "Don't they know we're bringing them the plague?"
Yeah.
So he saw psychoanalysis as something equivalent to the plague, or the Pandora's box that it would open up for Americans?
Well, it's an enigmatic comment, but I think that what he had in mind was his sense already that America was a place that wasn't going to warm really well to the idea that Freud was bringing, that we may not be able to have certainty and optimism and and success in everything that we do, and he was coming here to spread doubt. And in America, doubt can be a plague.
Well, I wonder about other ways that this can be used. We're talking about the military. I could see businesses saying, we want more happy workers. We want more productive workers. Let's put them through some kind of positive psychology training.
Exactly. And I think that this has already been going on for many years, that corporations have been really interested in these kinds of techniques. And in fact, it just the fact the Army is interested in it reflects the way that the Army is becoming more and more of a corporation.
One more question. A listener wants to know, wants a clarification on Seligman's findings with the troops. Does this apply to people who've only been in combat or anyone in the Army?
This is actually something that's going to be implemented by the drill instructors with recruits. So
the Southern drill instructors?
Yes, the people who are learning to develop this. Seligman says that the drill instructors score highest among the soldiers in the capacity to love and be loved. And so these are the people that are going to implement the positive psychology program and in fact, are already being trained in it. There's plenty of documentation of this. If you just go on the internet, there's lots of guys who are going through this that are blogging as they go through the program.
And are they saying that they're enjoying it?
The trajectory of most of the stories is, I thought this was going to be nonsense, but I'm not so sure that it is. And, you know, they'll tell stories about how they used a technique when their wife called them up upset. And
Then it's good.
It worked out for them.
The War on Unhappiness is in the September issue of Harper's Magazine, the issue that's on the newsstands now. My great thanks to Gary Greenberg, who wrote it, for visiting with us again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.